Good morning. Glad to see everybody here. Everybody's on Xenos time this morning, coming in late. That's how we do things. Welcome to Xenos East. I'm glad to see everybody here. We're going to be continuing our series in Matthew. We're coming up on the end of it. So we're going to be in Matthew, starting in chapter 26 today. I encourage you to turn there. Maybe take some notes in your Bible. That's okay. I take notes in mine all the time. And while you're doing that, I'm going to go ahead and pray for us. Lord, I thank you for this opportunity to study your word. We can learn a lot by the way Jesus handled himself during his trial. And I pray that that comes out. I pray that we can learn those lessons that you would have us learn from here. I pray that you teach us through your word today, God. Don't let me get in your way. Don't let my clumsy words get in the way of what you want to say to us today, but I pray that we can learn what you have for us today to learn. Amen. All right, so we have been studying for the last several weeks, really, the last week of Jesus' life on earth, and now we're coming up on the last day of it, and it's pretty dramatic, a lot of stuff going on, and today we're going to take a look at the trial that Jesus is about to go through. In fact, he goes through more than one trial on this last day. He gets, as we'll see, he gets bounced back and forth between the church trial and the civil trial, and in fact, in Matthew doesn't record all of them. Even in the civil trial, he gets bounced back and forth between some different people. So, what I want to do is take a look at what Jesus, how he handled himself, the things that he did, things that he didn't do during these trials. And while we're doing that, I want to keep in mind this passage that we studied last week. This is from Matthew 26:53, where Jesus tells his disciple, he says, "Do you think that I cannot appeal to my Father and he will at once put at my disposal more than 12 legions of angels?" Keep in mind that Jesus could do this. 12 legions of angels would be around 60,000 angels. That's a lot. That's a lot of angels. Can't imagine any human army would be able to stand up to that, 60,000 angels. And he says, "I can do that at any time." But he doesn't. And so I want to keep that in mind. Think about that as we see what he goes through in these trials. So let's take a look at 26, starting in 57. This is right after Jesus was arrested. It says, "Those who had seized Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and the elders were gathered together. But Peter was following him at a distance as far as the country, or as the courtyard of the high priest, and he entered in and sat down with the officers to see the outcome. Now the chief priests and the whole council kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. They did not find any, even though many false witnesses came forward. But later on, two came forward and said, 'This man stated, I am able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days. All right, so they arrested Jesus. They took him to Caiaphas. Caiaphas was the high priest at the time. And this is about 1 a.m. This is really late or early, depending on your perspective. So late at night, though, I mean, it's everybody who's respectable should be asleep by now. And yet they take him away to Caiaphas, who, oddly enough, wasn't in bed. He knew what was coming. He was expecting him. And so they take him to him, and he starts this trial in the middle of the night in private. And the chief priest, the whole council was there. Looks like they were all in on it. They all knew what was coming. And they kept trying to obtain false testimony against Jesus so that they might put him to death. It's interesting that they're trying to find false testimony. The problem is they couldn't find any true testimony against him. So they're looking for false testimony. They're not interested in justice. They're not interested in Jesus being punished for the things that he did, the crimes that he's committed. They know that he hasn't committed any. So they're looking for false testimony here. And yet they couldn't find any. Even though they had a lot of false witnesses, the problem was they kept contradicting one another. And you can't have that. That doesn't work out well. So they couldn't find any false witnesses that would help them out until somebody came along and said that he said he was able to destroy the temple of God and to rebuild it in 3 days, which is not exactly what he said. Again, false witnesses. So let's read on. It says, the high priest stood up and said to him, do you not answer? Or you do not answer? What is it that these men are testifying against you? But Jesus kept silent. And the high priest said to him, I adjure you by the living God that you tell us whether you are the Christ, the Son of God. And Jesus said to him, you have said it yourself. Nevertheless, I tell you, hereafter you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of power, coming on the clouds of heaven. All right, so all these false witnesses are coming up. They're all accusing Jesus of all kinds of crazy things. And yet, Jesus kept silent. He didn't stand up for himself. He didn't demand his rights. He didn't demand to face his accusers. He didn't do any of that stuff. He just kept silent. He let them, they were contradicting themselves. They didn't need him to get involved. And in fact, he stayed silent until the high priest said, tell us whether you are the Son of God, the Christ, the Son of God. All right, so now this trial has gone from being about what Jesus has done, whether or not he committed crimes. The whole trial boils down to whether or not Jesus is the Christ, the Messiah that they've been expecting. Is he the Son of God? That's what this trial has become. And all of a sudden, Jesus decides now is the time to speak up. And he says, well, you said it yourself. You said it yourself. In fact, Jesus had been saying it all along. We know that Jesus had not been quiet about this. He'd been talking to them. He'd been out publicly preaching about this all along, saying that he's the Messiah, calling himself the Son of Man, which is a title for the Messiah from the Old Testament, doing miracles to prove that what he said is true. And so he said, you said it yourself. Yeah, that's right. I'm the Messiah. And he said, in fact, soon you're going to see me sitting at the right hand of power. That means pretty soon, right now, you think you're trying me. You think you're the judge, but pretty soon, I'm going to be the judge. Think about that. Think about that when it comes down to your verdict. What's going to happen when I am the judge? Well, Caiaphas didn't like that. So we can read on. It says, the high priest tore his robes. And he said, he has blasphemed. What further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you have now heard the blasphemy. What do you think? And they answered, he deserves death. Then they spat in his face and beat him with their fists. And the others slapped him and said, prophesy to us, you Christ, who was the one who hit you. All right, so Jesus says, yep, I'm the Messiah. So now they decided, all right, well, let's sit down and do a thorough investigation to see if that is true. Right? Is that what happened? No. What happened? Well, Caiaphas, the high priest, tore his robes. Tore his robes. What does that mean? Why do they tear their robes? I tell you what, I grew up in the height of Hulkamania. So whenever I see something like this, this is what I think of. I think of Hulk Hogan tearing his shirt off, you know, with I Am a Real American playing in the background, and he's flamboyantly putting his hand up to his ear, telling his little Hulkamaniacs to take their vitamins and say their prayers. That's not what was going on. But now you'll forever, whenever you see Caiaphas in the Bible, you're going to think of Hulk Hogan tearing off his robes. Now, that's not what this was about. They would tear their robes. Tearing their robes was, they didn't just rip them off like Hulk Hogan's doing here. They would just tear them open. And it was an outward sign of grief or of offense. They'd been offended. Very dramatic. It was a way to demonstrate that this is a big deal to them. And sometimes you would see them, they put ashes on their heads or wear sackcloth if they're in grief. Sackcloth is a very coarse fiber that they would wear. There's not a lot to compare that to in our day. I mean, if somebody's in mourning, they'll wear black maybe. In the movies, they shout, no, at the sky, you know, that kind of thing. It's very dramatic and it's very outward. But I don't know that he really was that upset by this, but he was making a big show of it for sure. Let's get that off of there. All right. So he says, what further need do we have of witnesses? Behold, you've heard the blasphemy. He said, well, we don't need witnesses. I know all these guys are fake. We didn't need these guys after all. You heard the blasphemy. Now, it's only blasphemy if it's not true. And they're not interested in whether or not it's true. In fact, they probably know that it is true, but they don't care. So he says, we don't need any witnesses. You've all heard it yourself. What do you think? And they say, well, he deserves death. Unanimously, the Sanhedrin, they all voted that he deserves death. But the problem with that is they don't have the authority to mete that out. They used to. Back in the day, they used to, for blasphemy, they would kill somebody. But when the Romans took over, they took away the local church. They took away their ability to put people to death. So even though they think he deserves death, they have to go to the Romans and ask, pretty please, if they can put him to death. They couldn't do it themselves. So instead, they decided that they spit in his face, and they beat him with their fists. And other people were slapping him, so they're mistreating the prisoner. They're beating him up pretty bad. And they're slapping him around. What they're doing here, they're saying, prophesy for us, you Christ. What are they doing there? They're mocking him. They slap him. Someone would hit him from behind and say, well, if you're a prophet, prophesy. Who was the one who hit you? That kind of stuff. They're mocking him, publicly humiliating Jesus to make it easier for them, I think, to put him to death. So there's a lot of injustices going on in this trial. So let's take a look at that. Let's take a break from the passage for just a minute and take a look at some of the injustice that happens here. First of all, the arrest. There was a lot of bad stuff that happened during the arrest. It was instigated by a bribed traitor. That's not good. You're not allowed to give or take bribes, but that's what they did. They bribed Judas. In fact, it says right in Exodus 23:8, it says, you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. Bribes are a big no-no. Not supposed to give them, not supposed to take them, and yet that's exactly what happened. That's why Caiaphas was awake. That's why all the whole Sanhedrin, all the people were there awake at 1 in the morning waiting for Jesus to show up. They knew what was going down because they bribed a guy to do it. That's not cool. That was unjust. They did it after sunset. Now, this is not a biblical rule, but it was a rule in the Sanhedrin that they couldn't take legal action against somebody after the sunset. It had to be done during daylight. In other words, you can't do this stuff in secret. You have to do it out in the light where everybody can see. That's not what happened. It was 1 in the morning. So that was against their rules. So the arrest was unjust. That's the legal equivalent of not having a warrant, right? What happens when you don't have a warrant and you arrest somebody, you get into their house and you go through their stuff? Well, that gets thrown right out, doesn't it? On that basis alone, he should have been let go. But then we've got this ecclesiastical trial. Ecclesiastical trial means the trial before the church, before the leaders of the church. That's what we just read about. There was a lot of funny business going on there, too. You may have noticed. First of all, they conducted the trial before the morning sacrifice. You're not allowed to do that. Morning sacrifice had to be first. That's how you start the day. And then you could do any of your trials that you're allowed to do, that you needed to do. But that's not what they did. They just jumped right into it in the middle of the night. Not allowed to do that. There was no investigation, as we discussed. This was not about investigating something. This is about making sure that this guy gets put to death. In fact, it was the judge's job to investigate. It was the judge's job. It wasn't like today where we have the judge and the judge hears both sides of the argument. The judges in that day were supposed to, one of them was supposed to argue for the defense. And they were supposed to do a thorough investigation. This is from Deuteronomy 19. It says, the judges shall investigate thoroughly. And if the witness is a false witness, they had a few of those, what's supposed to happen to them? Well, the false witness, and he is accused of his brother falsely, then you shall do to him just as he intended to do to his brother. Thus you shall purge evil from among you. They have to investigate thoroughly. And if they find that they have a false witness, they're supposed to punish that guy with the punishment that he wanted to give to the one he was witnessing against. That didn't happen. So these judges were not doing their job according to the rules, according to the Bible, what they know they're supposed to be doing. This clicker is giving out on me. All right. So there weren't any real witnesses, right? They were all false witnesses. All of them were fake. That's a problem because they're supposed to have, if you're going to condemn somebody, you're supposed to have more than one witness. It says, on the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. Well, how many did they have that were real, true? None, not a one. Unless you count Jesus himself. So there's a problem there. It was held in secret. They're not allowed to have they were not allowed to have trials at midnight in secret any more than we are today. Not allowed to have secret trials. Trials are supposed to be a matter of public record. And so that's a problem. That's a big problem. They did it in secret because they were afraid that if they did it publicly, the crowd would tear them apart. Let's see. The origin of the charges. Who started these charges? The Sanhedrin, when they were hearing a trial, it wasn't supposed to be that they accused somebody of something and then they did the investigation. They were just judges. What was supposed to happen is someone would come before them and accuse someone else. The origin of the charges was not within the Sanhedrin, in other words. And then they would be able to investigate. They were impartial. They'd be able to see whether or not it was true. Well, what happened here is they originated these charges. They're the ones who went out and bribed somebody and went after Jesus themselves. They weren't allowed to do that. That's like a judge going out today and looking around for any misdeeds and then grabbing somebody off the street and dragging them into their trial. That doesn't happen. The judges, they're supposed to be apart from that, separate from that, so that they can judge impartially. So they were unimpartial. They were unkind. The judges were supposed to be kind. Just like today, they're supposed to be innocent until proven guilty. The judges were supposed to be kind to their prisoners. They were supposed to be just. They were supposed to be impartial. And that's not at all what we see here, is it? They were trying to drum up witnesses that would speak against Jesus. They're accusing him of all kinds of things. They're being very dramatic. It's almost like a reality show. They're tearing their robes and stuff. It's very, very shady. Very much against not only the Bible and what the Bible says they were supposed to do, it was very much against their own traditions and what they were their own traditions said they were supposed to do. Not good at all. And then we take a look at this verdict. Well, it was unanimous, and that's actually a problem. In our day, we think of a unanimous decision as what you need to have somebody put to death. But these are judges. They're not a jury. And remember, I said that the judge was supposed to defend. One of the judges was supposed to be the defense of the witness, of the accused. And in fact, there was a tradition where is if someone was found, it was a unanimous decision against someone, that means that the defense didn't do their job right. And so that was supposed to be a red flag, that if all the judges, the whole council voted against somebody, then somebody wasn't doing their job right and defending them very well. And yet we have a unanimous decision here. He was convicted on only one witness. The only real witness they had was Jesus himself. Jesus is the one who said that he's the Messiah. They didn't really investigate whether or not that was true. They just assumed that it's not, and therefore it's blasphemy. So they didn't do the investigation, but Jesus was really the only witness they had. And this is from Deuteronomy. It says, a single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. They didn't have any other witnesses. They only had Jesus. Not allowed to do that. The high priest tore his robes. We talked about that, right? That seems like a funny thing to do, and he's being very dramatic, but guess what? High priests weren't allowed to do that. This is from Leviticus 21:10. It says, the priest, who is the highest among his brothers, on whose head the anointing oil has been poured, and who has been consecrated to wear the garments, shall not uncover his head, nor tear his clothes. He's supposed to have some dignity. He's supposed to have this impartial dignity. What it means when they're tearing their robes is that they're too emotionally invested in what's going on. He's not supposed to be that way. And yet, we know that he did. So clearly he was impartial, or he was not impartial. Lots of problems going on here. They voted simultaneously, and this is the last one about this. The vote was simultaneous. Remember, he says, what other witnesses do we need? What do you think? And they all said he's guilty. But what was supposed to happen in a trial like this in front of the Sanhedrin was they would vote individually, and they would vote from the youngest to the oldest. That way the youngest people weren't influenced by the votes of the older ones. That's how they were supposed to do things. It's not what happened. This trial, by any standard, should have been thrown out. And yet, it wasn't. It was very unjust. And Jesus kept silent. He didn't call in his legions, his 12 legions of angels. He just let them. Let them do what they're going to do. And they wanted to put him to death really bad, but they couldn't. So what do? They go over and they throw this over to the civil courts. They throw it over to Pontius Pilate. And so now we read on in chapter 27, verse 11. We see here. Jesus stood before the governor. And the governor questioned him, saying, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said to him, "It is as you say." And while he was being accused by the chief priests and the elders, he did not answer. And then Pilate said to him, Do you not hear how many things they testify against you?" And he did not answer him with regard to even a single charge, so that the governor was quite amazed. All right, so here we have another example of Jesus keeping his mouth shut. He said he did not answer. He answered the Pilate when he said, "Are you the king of the Jews?" He said, "It is as you say." He was respectful. But when the dog and pony show came through from the scribes and the elders and the chief priests, he didn't respond to any of that. He didn't respond to any. And I think Pilate knew. He knew that there was something shady going on here. And he said, "Why don't you testify? Why don't you answer these people, what they're testifying against you?" And again, he didn't answer. And what do we see? We see that the governor was amazed by this. He's probably used to something more like Jerry Springer, where people are shouting at each other and screaming at each other, and it's this circus, you know, of accusations back and forth. And here we've got this guy who's clearly been mistreated. His hair is probably still wet from the spit from the people who are spitting on him. He's been beat up, arrested. It's about 6 in the morning, so he knows that they've been mistreating him all night. And yet, he says nothing against them. He doesn't point his finger at them and saying, "Well, yeah, but what about what they did?" You don't hear that from Jesus. And he's amazed by it. He knows that these guys are trying to drum up some problems. They're trying to make up these things. And Jesus doesn't even bother to defend himself. It got his attention. Now, at the feast, the governor was accustomed to release for the people any one prisoner whom they wanted. And at that time, they were holding a notorious prisoner called Barabbas. So that the people gathered together, Pilate said to them, "Whom do you want me to release for you, Barabbas or Jesus, who was called the Christ?" For he knew that because of envy they had handed him over. And while he was sitting on the judgment seat, his wife sent him a message saying, "I have nothing to do with that righteous man, for last night I suffered greatly in a dream because of him." So we've got this this out. Pilate knows what's going down here. He knows that Jesus didn't do anything wrong. And so during the feast, this is the Feast of Passover. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago. It was a custom for them to release a prisoner, a political prisoner for them, whoever they wanted. And so he's like, "We got this out." So he brings out this guy named Barabbas, who is, as it says here, a notorious prisoner. Notorious is kind of an understatement, maybe. We can read about this in Mark chapter 15. It says that the man named Barabbas had been imprisoned with the insurrectionists who had committed murder in the insurrection. We also know that he was a robber. So this guy was in with some insurrectionists, some people who were against the Roman government. And they would kill people to get what they wanted done. They had to steal to get the money to fund their insurrection. And this is the guy. This is the guy. He says, "You don't want it." So it should be clear, right? You've got this hardened criminal who's murdered people, and you've got this guy over here who's been healing people. Which one do you want? Right? Which one do you want? That should be an easy choice. And remember, this guy's called the Christ. He points out, do you want Barabbas, who's a murderer and an insurrectionist and a thief, or do you want this guy who's the Christ, the Messiah, the one who's your chosen one? Which one do you want? Well, He did that. Why did he point that out? Because he knew that that was because of envy that they handed him over. He knew that this guy had something special. He knew the crowds loved Jesus, and the Sanhedrin didn't like that. They wanted all the power, and he knew that it was because they were envious. That's why he pointed it out. Well, and then he knows that he gets this letter from his wife that says, have nothing to do with this righteous man. She knows that Christ is righteous. She says, keep your hands out of this. She's warning him. Don't get involved in this. He's a righteous man. So Pilate knows that Jesus is innocent. He knows there's nothing wrong with Jesus. He's trying to give him every opportunity to get out. Well, what happens? The chief priests and the elders persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas. So they had sent people into the crowds. Maybe they even brought a lot of the crowd themselves in to ask for Barabbas and to put Jesus to death. The governor said to them, which of the two do you want me to release? It's like, what? No, wait a minute. Which of these two do you really want? And they're like, we want Barabbas. And Pilate said to them, what will I do with Jesus, who was called the Christ? Remember, he's the Christ. Well, they said, crucify him. And he said, why? What evil has he done? But they kept shouting all the more, saying, crucify him. So we have the chief priests and the elders. They had planted people in the crowd. They had maybe even threatened people in the crowd because they had the authority to excommunicate people. If you kick people out of the church, that means they don't get into heaven. They had a lot of authority. A lot of people looked up to these guys. That was part of the problem. And so they persuaded the crowds to ask for Barabbas. They were in there influencing the vote, in other words. They didn't want Jesus to get out. So what will I do with Jesus? That's a good question. I think that's a question a lot of us need to answer. What do we do about Jesus? He is the Christ. What are we going to do about him? We all have to make that decision. What do you do about Jesus, this guy who's going through all these trials? What do we do about him? Well, we know what the crowd wanted. They said, crucify him. And he says, what evil has he done? A crucifixion is a big deal. A crucifixion is not just something that was every day. I mean, they had crucified people, that's true, but it wasn't something that was that you did on a whim. A crucifixion, that's like throwing somebody in an electric chair just to watch them fry. That's not what happened. You didn't have people wearing crosses around their necks back then. It's like wearing a needle full of a deadly poison around your neck or something. This was a method of execution. And it was probably the most painful and drawn-out method of execution people have ever come up with. And yet, what do we want to do with him? They said, crucify him. Why? Why do people hate Jesus so much? Why do people today hate Jesus so much? What evil has he done? Pilate knew. Pilate knew this was a mistake. Let's see if he stands up for himself. Well, when Pilate saw that he was accomplishing nothing, but rather instead a riot was starting, he took water and he washed his hands in front of the crowd, saying, I am innocent of this man's blood. See to that yourselves. And all the people said, his blood shall be on us and on our children. And then he released Barabbas for them. But after having Jesus scourged, he handed him over to be crucified. So he gives in. He was not a very good leader. Instead, he decides to buckle to public opinion. And he says, and part of the reason was that he saw that this riot was starting. The rioting was a big deal. Jerusalem was such a thorn in the side of Rome. Rome conquered people all the time. They had all kinds of occupied territories, and none of them had as much problems, gave them as much problems as Jerusalem. There was always some kind of insurrection. There was always some kind of riot, and they were really starting to crack down. And Pilate knew that if he had a riot on his hands again, there's going to be some serious repercussions. So he's like, screw it. You know what? I'm washing my hands of all this. Take them and do what you're going to do. Take them and do what you're going to do. And then I think this might have been a last-ditch effort to maybe get Jesus out of the execution. He had him scourged. This is not something that you would do to a prisoner that was about to be executed. A scourging is not just a whooping. You know, it's not like they just took him out back and roughed him up. A scourge is a whip. It's a handle, and it's usually done with what was called a cat of nine tails, and it was had several tails on it. All of them had bits of sharp bone in them, and when they would hit somebody with it, it would just strip the flesh right off of them. And they would beat them that way. And that's what they did to Jesus. Very bloody, very brutal, very painful. But there's no point in doing that to somebody who's about to be crucified. That's like taking somebody who's about to be executed off of death row, and they take him out back and kick him around for a while and beat him up. There's no point. He's about to be executed. What are you accomplishing here? But that's what happened. That was not normally what was done to prisoners who were about to be executed, as we'll see. So let's talk about more injustice. This is the criminal trial. What are the injustices that happened here? Well, they changed the charge from blasphemy to sedition, and that wasn't clear from the passage that we just read, but it's more clear in Luke's passage, because what happened is that while blasphemy was a big deal to the Jewish courts, the Roman courts didn't really care about that. That he would have just said, well, if he's a blasphemer, then you deal with it yourselves, and which is what he tried to do originally. He tried to just shove it back on them. If he broke your law, it's fine. Deal with it your way. But they couldn't, because they couldn't execute him. They wanted to execute him real bad. And in Luke, what we see here is when they're talking to Pilate, they begin to accuse him, saying, we found this man misleading our nation and forbidding to pay taxes to Caesar and saying that he himself is Christ, a king. Now it's a bigger deal. It's not just, okay, he said some things about your religion that you don't like and that's your problem. It's, okay, I have to take seriously any threat to anybody who's saying that they're the true king and the emperor is not. So they changed the charge. Now it's not blasphemy anymore. Now it's sedition. A capital offense, of course. Well, Pilate did seek to get Jesus to incriminate himself. They weren't allowed to do that. He was like, come on, tell me what happened. Tell me who you are. Are you the Christ, the king? Remember, he's trying to get him to draw him out. Are you the king? Say that you're a king so I can do something about this. They weren't allowed to do that. They weren't allowed to get the prisoners to incriminate themselves. They had to investigate. Pilate found him innocent, and yet he condemned him anyway. He didn't find anything wrong with Jesus. Not a thing. In fact, he said in John 18:38, he went out to the Jews and he said to them, I find no guilt in him. He's innocent. So lock him up, right? That doesn't make sense. That's like a judge saying, yep, you're innocent. Now you got to go to prison. That doesn't make any sense. And yet that's what we see. Pilate found this guy innocent, found Jesus innocent, not a problem with him at all, and yet he condemned him anyway. He had Jesus beaten to satisfy the Jewish officials. He was scourged. I think he might have been trying to maybe sate their bloodlust a little bit. Maybe if I rough him up, if I beat him, if I have him scourged, maybe they'll back off. Maybe that's what he was trying to do. I don't know. But I do know that you're not allowed to do that to your prisoners. And there's a good reason for it, as we'll see here in a few minutes, why you don't want to beat somebody who's about to be crucified. But we've got a little bit more to the story, because after the trial, after his trials, I should say, they turned him over to the guards. And now let's see how polite the guards were to him. The soldiers of the governor took Jesus into the praetorium, and they gathered the whole Roman cohort around him, and they stripped him, and they put a scarlet robe on him. And after twisting together a crown of thorns, they put it on his head, and a reed in his right hand, and they knelt down before him, and they mocked him, saying, Hail, King of the Jews. All right, so what's going on here? First of all, this was not a handful of guys in an empty room making fun of Jesus. They had the whole Roman cohort. That's 360 guys. 360 armed and armored, well-trained Roman soldiers around one guy who's already been beaten, who's already been sentenced, even though he was innocent. And now what do? They decide, well, we need to mock him. We need to beat him up. And so they strip him, and they put a scarlet robe on him, so they are humiliating him. And this scarlet robe was like a king's robe, right? So they're dressing him up like a king. They put this robe around him. They put the crown on him, this crown of thorns. They put this reed in his hand like a scepter. And they're kneeling down before him, and they're mocking him. Where the Jewish officials were mocking him, saying, "Prophesy for us if you're the Christ." They're saying, "Oh, you're a king, all right, so we're going to kneel down before you. Hail, King of the Jews." And they're mocking him. They're treating him like garbage. They're humiliating him further. And it goes on. They spat on him, and they took the reed, and they began to beat him on the head. And after they had mocked him, they took the scarlet robe off of him and put his own garments back on him, and they led him away to crucify him. And as they were coming out, they found a man of Cyrene named Simon, who they pressed into service to bear his cross. They took that reed, and they were beating him on the head. And what was on his head already? A crown of thorns. They were hammering those thorns deeper and deeper into his head. And if you've ever had a head wound, you know how they bleed. He's already lost a lot of blood from the scourging and from the beatings. And now he's got this crown of thorns all the way around his head, and they're hitting him in it with a reed, so he bleeds even more. And they're coming out, and they had to get this guy named Simon to carry the cross for him. Now, why is this significant? Well, traditionally what would happen is if you crucify somebody, you would have to, they would part of the whole deal was they would carry their cross through town up to where they crucify people. And so they had to bear this cross through the town. That's why you don't beat them up so bad, because then they're too weak to carry the cross. And we know from other accounts, Jesus was trying to do that. They made him carry it for a while, but they couldn't. He couldn't. He'd lost too much blood. He'd taken too much of a beating, and he couldn't physically carry it anymore. Now, Jesus was no wimp. This is not like he was just, you know, a pansy. Right, and he just couldn't carry it. This is a guy, remember, this is a week ago, he was driving the priests out of the temple, flipping tables, and accusing them of turning the house of prayer into a robber's den, right? This is the same guy who for the last 3 years has been on foot walking all over Israel. It's estimated 2,500 miles that he walked in those 3 years on foot. He was a hardy guy. He was no wimp. But he couldn't carry the cross because they beat him up so bad. He lost so much blood. He was weakened. You didn't beat prisoners who were about to be executed, especially the ones who were about to be crucified, because you wanted them to be up on that cross a long time. That's what the point was. The point was to give the maximum amount of pain over the maximum amount of time. People sometimes would last on the cross for days. And yet we see Jesus didn't last to the end of the day. Why? Because he lost so much blood already. You're not supposed to beat up your prisoners before you execute them. And yet they did. And that's why they had to get this guy. He's just some guy on the street. And they're like, "Hey, you carry it." You know, I don't, that would be weird. But I'm sure he wasn't about to say no to these guards. So they got somebody else to carry the cross for him. And that's where we're going to stop our passage this week. We're going to look at the crucifixion next week. But before we wrap up, I want to take a look at some more of the injustices that we saw. Let's just get an overview of what we've seen today. We saw an invalid and illegal arrest. He wasn't allowed to be arrested the way he was, and yet it happened. An unjust and illegal ecclesiastical trial. Trial before the church leaders was a farce. Should never have happened. Should have been thrown out. The verdict, just like the trial, was a mess. Should never have happened. They did not have the evidence that was sufficient to convict Jesus. It was brutal. He had brutal and illegal treatment by the Jewish officials. They hit him. They smacked him around. They're not allowed to do that kind of stuff to prisoners. Pilate treated him unjustly. Yes, granted, he tried to get him out. He tried to find a way to appease both the Jews and the Roman, but when push came to shove, he buckled to public opinion, and he mistreated Jesus. He was found innocent and yet convicted anyway. That's the worst. That's the worst part. The judge said there's nothing wrong with him. Go ahead and take him away. That's awful. And he was brutalized and mistreated by the Roman officials. They publicly humiliated him in front of the whole cohort of Roman guards. And they beat him publicly. They weren't allowed to do that stuff. Now, imagine today a Christian is treated this way. The outcry, the social media backlash that would happen on something like this today. And yet, Jesus remained silent for most of it. He never demanded his rights. He never demanded a fair trial. Probably because he knew there was no such thing. Think about that. Remember what I said at the beginning, that he could pull in 12 legions of angels any time to put a stop to it, and he never did. Jesus talked a lot about humility and meekness, and now he demonstrated it for everybody. So what are some lessons that we can learn through these trials that Jesus went through? First of all, why did Christ have to put up with this? Why did he do it? What would motivate him to do that? What would motivate me to do that? I can't think of anything that would motivate me to be put up with that kind of nonsense. You know, we all think we're tough. We all think that we can just power through whatever comes up our way. But the truth is, I know for me, when things get tough, I want to quit. When things get hard, I want to quit. I know when I ride my bike, I like to ride my bike, and I don't get to do it during the winter. So when the spring comes, I want to hop on my bike, and I'm like, yeah, last year I was riding 50, 60 miles, so I want to get in there and then start big, you know. And after the first mile, I'm like, oh, this stinks. I'm not really into this. Right? It's hard, and I want to quit because it's difficult. It's painful. We think we're tougher than we are. If there's a way out, if there's a reasonable way out, and there certainly was for Jesus, why didn't he take it? Well, take a look at this passage from Galatians. I think it sums it up very concisely. It says, Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law, having become a curse for us. That's a pretty succinct way of saying it. What is the curse of the law? Paul is saying all of us are under the curse of the law. Now, we think about the law as we like law and order. We respect the law right up until it doesn't work for us, right? And the problem is, all of us, it's not the God's law was not working for any of us because we all break it. God has a moral law, and it's perfect, and his standard is perfection. And all of us have broken it, every single one of us. And so we're under the curse of the law. That means all of us are under this curse, meaning we have this life sentence, or really a death sentence hanging over our heads. All of us deserve the punishment. That's a curse. But the Bible and God, in his mercy, has allowed for a substitute. In the Old Testament, he would allow a substitute to be sacrificed. And that was a symbol. It was a symbol for a substitute being allowed to pay for the sins of someone else. It wasn't real. Those lambs and those goats, they didn't actually pay for any sins, but it was a substitute. It was to remind them that there is a way out from this curse. And God will provide the substitute, and that's what Christ has done. He has become the curse. He has become the substitute for us so that he dies and we don't have to. That's why he put up with this. That's why he did it. For you and for me. Through all of that, he was looking forward and saying, I will be able now to have a relationship with my people. If you want that relationship, God's not going to force it on you. If you want to rebel against God and you want to go your own way, you're allowed to do that, and there are consequences for that. But if you want to have a relationship with God, all you have to say is, I want Christ's death to pay for my sins. You go to God and say, I can't work my way to you. I want that substitute to pay for me. And he did that for you so that we could have that relationship. What did we do about Jesus? That was the problem. That was the problem that Pilate had. That's the problem that we had. What are you going to do about Jesus? Are you going to accept that sacrifice that he made for you or not? Other lessons. I think often silence is more eloquent than words. I think that's something that we can learn from Jesus. Jesus didn't defend himself. He didn't have to. He could have stood up and said, I've been healing people for years now. He probably knew some people. He could have looked right in the eye. Remember your daughter? I healed her. Remember that one, the daughter of the girl? I brought her back to life. Remember Lazarus? You know about Lazarus, right? The guy who was dead for 4 days and I brought him back. You remember that, right? He could have, all of that, he could have just wheeled it out, but he didn't have to. He let his actions speak for themselves. In James 1, 19 through 20, it says, this you know, my beloved brethren, but everyone must be quick to hear and slow to speak and slow to anger, for the anger of man does not achieve the righteousness of God. Imagine the anger that would happen today if someone was mistreated, even a tenth of this, the way Jesus was treated. The anger. It's like our go-to thing these days is a protest. And now the protesting is not enough. Now we got to have counter-protests. We have protests against the people who are protesting something else. We all want to have our say. We all want to put their things on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. Can you imagine the twit storm that would have happened if this had happened today? Twitter would have been full. People get so angry and they want to be voiced and they want their rights and they demand the right to do what they want or whatever. And instead, what the Bible says and what Jesus demonstrated is that you should just be the person that you're supposed to be and be slow to anger, because your anger and my anger does not achieve the righteousness of God. We will not ever further the kingdom of God through our anger. There are things that we should be angry about, absolutely. Injustice, for certain, we should be angry about. But lashing out in anger does not achieve the righteousness of God. We see that Jesus remained calm and meek and humble. That word meek, it's a word that it would describe a war horse who was under control. A war horse was a very powerful animal. He could do a lot of damage if he was out of control. And yet, a well-trained war horse was meek, which means he was calm. And all that strength, all that power, all that potential for ferocious danger was under control. That's what meek means, and that's what Christ was. He had the power. He had the authority. He had the right to demand justice for himself, and he didn't. He was meek. He was humble. He was calm. We need to know the situation. What does God want accomplished here? Jesus, as I said earlier, he was a guy who, this is a week ago, he was in the temple flipping tables and yelling at people and chasing them out with a whip. He knew when to express his anger and how. And he knew when not to. Most of the time, it was not to. We need to know the situation. Behaving well speaks louder than demands for justice. I think that's something what we can learn from what Jesus has done. He didn't have to defend himself. This is from 1 Peter 2:12. It says, keep your behavior excellent among the Gentiles, non-believers, so that in the thing in which they slander you as evildoers, they may, because of your good deeds, as they observe them, glorify God in the day of visitation. What does that mean? Keep your behavior excellent among non-believers, because they're going to accuse you. Christians hate people. Christians don't like people who aren't like them. Christians do this, Christians do that. There's all kinds of accusations. We can defend ourselves by saying, well, yeah, what about this, what about that? And there's plenty of good things that Christians have done over the centuries. Or, more loudly than that, we can just live excellent lives. We can't be perfect. Part of that means apologizing when we're wrong. And I think that goes a long way with people. When you're wrong and you admit it, that's a big deal for people. So that when they see you doing these deeds, they're going to observe them and glorify you? No. The point is to glorify God. Jesus, through his life, glorified God in everything that he did. So that when his trial came, he didn't have to speak up. Anybody who was paying attention, anyone who would have listened to his defense, wouldn't have needed to hear it because they would have seen what Jesus, kind of person Jesus was. The people who he was defending himself against didn't want to hear it anyway. So he didn't bother. And finally, believe it or not, our safety, well-being, and comfort are not God's primary concern. They're not. They may be our primary concern. I know my comfort and well-being and safety are usually on top of my list. But God has bigger things in mind. But God has more important things, believe it or not, than our own personal safety and comfort. And so sometimes we may have to go through some uncomfortable situations. Sometimes we get into a situation and it's difficult and it's challenging, and maybe even we're losing sleep. It may even affect our health, and we say, well, clearly this isn't God's will. Really? Have you read the Bible? Have you seen the trials that he's called his people to go through? Not the least of which was Christ himself. This is what Christ had to say to his disciples. Blessed are you when men hate you and ostracize you and insult you and scorn you, and scorn your name as evil for the sake of the Son of Man. Be glad in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven. For the same way their fathers used to treat the prophets. What's he saying here? You're in good company. When people hate you because of me, when people mock you because of me, when you suffer because of me, you should be happy because you're in good company. They used to do the same thing to the prophets, right? The prophets were God's spokesmen and women, and they were murdered. And now they've done the same thing to Christ as we saw today. They did the same thing and worse to him. When we suffer for Christ, we suffer for our faith, we are in good company. And so, don't be surprised when that happens. Don't be shocked. Don't run away from it. Sometimes we just have to take it because there are better, bigger things involved than just our own personal safety and comfort. As Christ knew, the reward for his going through that was a relationship with us, the opportunity for us to be saved. And just that opportunity was enough for him to go through that. All right, we'll stop there. If you're a first-time guest, that's awesome. I'm glad you're here. We have free books over there if you want to grab one of those books. There's How Good is Good Enough and Discovering God. Both of those are very easy reads, and they might help solidify some questions that you may have or answer some questions that you may have about faith. If you're here and we're going to have a question and answer time, so I encourage you to think about it if you have a question or a comment that you want to make. But if you don't have a chance to do that, you also have this welcome card that was in the weekly update that you received when you came in. You can fill that out. We read those. If you have suggestions how we can make things better, that works too. Just fill that out. Drop it in the bag. We do read those. The bag is also for us to financially support our church. These lights don't stay on their own. We got to pay for that stuff. If this is not your church, though, we don't ask you for your money. We don't want your money, as a matter of fact. Just pass that thing on by. This is just for us. This is our church. We want to support it. It's an opportunity to do so. So, kids are in Oasis until 11:45. And so we want to make sure that they get picked up on time. But before then, we've got time for questions and comments. If you have a question or a comment you'd like to ask or make, just raise your hand. We'll bring you a microphone. Way up here.
Thanks for the teaching, as always, Adam. One comment I'd like to make on it, and it harkens back to something you hear a lot, especially in this day and age where everything is in your face. Mm-hmm. A lot of people who haven't come around yet will object to God in the sense of, I can't worship a God who would allow all these awful things to happen. Mm-hmm. When he has the power to stop it. And it makes me think of this, what we just talked about. And if I can borrow something from the civil rights movement, keep your eyes on the prize. Mm-hmm. I used to hear that a lot. And that's what I think Jesus was doing here.
Absolutely.
He could have stopped all of this, but that would not have accomplished God's will. Yeah. And he knew if he'd have spoke up in his defense that he would have won, mm-hmm. and the crucifixion would have never happened, and then we'd still be stuck trying to figure out how to save ourselves.
Yeah.
And it even goes through, I think, when you look at the course of history and these people that are coming saying, I can't worship a God that would allow all this. He's got his eye on that and what's going to happen at the end. Mm-hmm. We don't.
Right.
And so he's carrying it through just like Jesus knew he had to be silent to carry this out.
Yeah.
Because he was accomplishing God's will. And I think we often lose sight of that thing because we don't keep our eyes on the prize. We're just, like you say, we're concerned with what's comfortable and safe and what makes me feel good right now. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I shouldn't suffer.
Right.
And all these things. And we're just so delusional to ourselves, thinking that we don't deserve that or we shouldn't have to go through that in order to accomplish God's will.
Yeah.
But that was the perfect example of what it took to do that.
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, Hebrews 12:2, I think it is, that says that Jesus, who's the author and perfecter of our faith, it was because of the joy set before him that he endured the cross. The joy set before him was us, that relationship with us. That's why he did it. And that whole idea of that I can't believe in a God who doesn't do this or a God who would allow that, what you're saying is I can't believe in a God who would disagree with me. And the truth is, if you've ever had a personal relationship with anybody ever, there are disagreements. The fact that you disagree with God proves to me that he's real, not that he's not. And then, of course, the whole idea of suffering. We get this idea that suffering is the worst thing and that we should end it. But where does that idea come from? The nature without God is suffering. It's the only common experience that every living creature has is suffering. Why? It's natural. Why is it wrong? Well, I agree with you that it's wrong, but where do you get the idea that it would be wrong? Without God, what makes you think that it's wrong? If everything is just natural and natural processes, the whole thing of evolution, the idea of naturalism is that the strong devour the weak, that's suffering. That's natural. That shouldn't surprise us, and yet it does every time. Yeah, back here.
Everybody here has probably heard this before, but it bears repeating. Mm. You know, if I were the only one who would have ever accepted this offer, Jesus still would have died just for me.
Yeah.
That reminds me of Saving Private Ryan, where the guy, Private Ryan, has grown up. He's had a family. And he's an old man, and he comes to the grave of the guy who had died for him. And he's sitting there asking his wife, am I a good man? He's spent his whole life trying to feel like he had deserved that. So I guarantee you that guy never he never passed a day of his life when he didn't remember what that guy did for him. Yeah. Now, I don't get up every day remembering that Jesus went through this pain and suffering just for me. But the few times that I do, it changes my day. You know, if we got up and remembered this every day, Tuesday morning before we went to work, Friday, our words, our interactions with other people, our behavior, everything would change if we did that. It's a good goal.
Yeah, I agree. We have this idea. Every time I think about that, I think about, well, I start being bummed out about some inconvenience or whatever that's making me, quote, unquote, suffer. How can I even think that I'm suffering when I compare myself to what Christ has gone through for me? It totally changes your perspective. I agree. Yeah.
To piggyback on a little bit on what you said, you know, just in Luke, my favorite line or my favorite verse in the Bible is Luke 23, where Jesus, as they're pounding the nails in his hand, in his wrists, forgive them, Father, for they do not know what they do.
Yeah.
You know, in the midst of all of this, he's praying for us. We're, our sin's the one that put him in this mess. Right?
Yeah.
But he's praying not only for them at that time, but for us as well, because the eye on the prize, the love, that this is the ultimate demonstration of love, because he wants us all there.
Yeah.
It's for eternity to be spending with one another and with him.
Yeah, that's a great point. Spoiler alert, that's what we're going to talk about next week. Yeah. All right. Well, I've got one more, and then we'll pray.
Thank you for such an excellent teaching, especially the last quote that our safety, well-being, are not God's primary concerns. And we were listening, Chuck and I were listening to, some of you, I'm repeating this quote again, but listening to the interview in the radio program called The Voice of the Martyrs, and this Chinese girl, she's been put in a prison and being tortured and tortured, and it was a horrific torture. But she was so depressed, so hurt, physically hurt, and mentally beaten. And she asks God, Jesus, why are you doing this to me? And she said, I heard Jesus say, no, they are not persecuting you, they are persecuting me. Can I borrow your body? Mm. And her pain just went right through. He felt no more pains. Yeah. By the way, she's still alive and she's coming to Dayton on the April the 1st. Mm.
Yeah, that's it, though. That's the truth. They're not prosecuting us, they're prosecuting Christ. And that's the lesson that Paul had to learn when he was prosecuting the church. And Christ appeared to him and said, why are you persecuting me? He says, you, I'm not persecuting you. And he says, well, yeah, you're persecuting my church. That he closely identifies with us that way. Yeah, that's a great point. Oh, one more. Because you asked nice.
Thank you. I work in a hospital, and I had one of the girls that I work with talk about how the nurses had brought them some Easter eggs. And so the whole idea of Easter and Christ is kind of in our office. And there's a new girl who definitely doesn't believe Jesus is God, and she's been kind of like taunting some of the workers or some of the believers in the office. And another girl was like, yeah, I mean, she says it enough. She knows I'm real close by, and so she's saying it intentionally for me to hear. Yeah, Jesus is supposed to, like, die on the cross. Thank you, Jesus. I mean, just really, you know, just a huge mockery. And I thought, how interesting it's going to be in our office, because we have a lot of believers, but yet we have these people who are blatant in our face. Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, you could tell it's as it gets closer to time, we're going to have more interaction. So, you know, keep that in mind. Just pray for me, for opportunities, for all of us. I know as it gets closer to Easter, we're going to have a lot of opportunities.
Yeah.
But it just blows me away that people are so blatant mocking Christ.
Yeah. It's not new, is it?
No.
Nope.
Still, though, it's hard to hear. It's hard to hear.
It is hard to hear, but it's not shocking. I mean, they've been doing it since Christ was around, right? So that's not new. Yeah, well, this is the time of year, though. It's a good opportunity for us to talk about it. I mean, a lot of Catholics and other people who celebrate Lent, that's a good time for. I mean, it's on people's minds. It's a good chance. All right, let's take a moment to pray together. If you'd like to pray out loud, raise your hand, and we'll bring you a microphone.